Hello, I'm Oliver Wong.
And I'm Morgan Rhodes. You're listening to Heat Rocks.
Morgan and I wanted to kick off 2020 and the 2020s in general with a look back at the decade we just left behind. And to do so, the two of us have compiled our favorite 10 of the 2010s.
Sunbeaming on his BDBs, exhausted. Tossing footballs with his ashy black ankles.
Surfboard, surfboard, graining on that wood, graining, graining on that wood.
Morgan, before we actually get to the music part of it, I'm just wondering, what did the 2010s mean to you personally and or professionally?
You know, those two things melded for me because I began the 2010s with a stint on KPFK, a show called The Listening Station, and I was on there from 4 to 6 a.m. So it was the beginning of my career there, which led to me being a music supervisor. So I started this decade not being a music supervisor, and it went to from middle of nowhere in 2012 to today. So all that's happened pretty fast.
Yeah.
The beginning of the 10s was a wonderful time, I thought, musically. I thought there was some fire that came out. I thought the music business came out smoking, especially where it related to indie soul music and avant-garde soul music. And quite frankly, although my regional bias heretofore has been well documented, I thought the West was won in the 2010s, secured and won.
Mm. I think for me, when I think back on my 2010s, certainly it's very much bound up into the fact that most of my 40s have been spent in this decade. And turning 40, and this was back in 2012, you know, what came with it was a growing sense, maybe an existential sense of my own mortality, which is never awesome, but perhaps necessary as a life phase. Certainly the rest of the decade has been spent in the general awareness of our oncoming or potential global apocalypse, you know, the basics like that. So I don't know if I was necessarily happier into 2010s as opposed to into 2000-aughts, because I really enjoyed my 30s. My 30s were awesome. 40s have been a little bit more somber, I suppose. But maybe that's just an inevitable product of age. Certainly, I think professionally, it was fantastic. I got, as a college professor, I got my tenure. I was promoted to full. My one and only so far academic book all came out. I am very proud of a lot of the things I wrote outside of academia in terms of music, essays, reviews, articles, etc. And certainly, I'm very, very proud of our show, which, of course, got launched this decade. And so I think when I imagine in maybe 10 years from now, when I look back on this decade, the things that are going to pop out to me is sort of where I came professionally during the decade, watching my daughter get older and age into adolescence. And I hopefully will be looking back on sort of, you know, our show as being like one of the high points. I mean, certainly looking at it right now in terms of recency bias, it's up there. And I
For
hope
sure.
that still remains the same even 10 years from now.
Well, we met in the 10s. We met in 2013. And so when I was looking at your list, and we'll get into that later, I thought at least one of these picks was the thing that brought us together. It was our first show together, Tuesday Reviews Day on KPCC. And had it not been for that, we wouldn't be here. So
no
shout
doubt.
Out to Jacob Margolis, KPCC, and Tuesday Reviews Day, RIP.
Yeah. Now, bringing back our theme for this episode, looking back on the 2010s, it's not that I imagined this would be super easy, but I figured I would have at the ready just a list of albums that, oh yeah, it has to be this and this. And certainly there were some of those albums that I knew automatically would make this. But it's trying to distinguish between, well, are these the best albums, the top albums, or favorite albums? So I'm wondering, when you sat down with this, what approach did you take? What was your methodology for kind of winnowing this?
You know, this was more difficult than I would have thought.
Mm.
When I first approached it, I was like, well, you're just going to step into it as a tastemaker. So your list is going to be akin to Pitchfork and NPR and Rolling Stone and Vice and all that kind of stuff. You're gonna do a tastemakers list.
Yeah.
But I realized, although there were great albums on all of those lists for all of those years, what I bumped was what I picked.
Yeah.
And I went on what stuck with me, what I kept going back to, and what I could bump continuously without having to be like, okay, next. And so that's what narrowed my pick down. And when I looked at what I ended up with, I was like, there's 6 degrees of separation, even less, between the artists that I picked. Some of them featured on each other's albums in the tens.
Yeah.
And so I stayed in the family and stayed a bit west, if I'm mm-hmm. honest.
Mm-hmm.
But I went with what made me feel good in this decade.
Right. And I think I approached it very much the same way. I know on some level the music critic in me wanted to try to sum up the decade via what I thought might have been the most important albums in terms of what defined the decade. But I'm not saying, number one, that's not an easy endeavor if one sets themselves to do it. But more to the point here, I'm just not that invested in it. And I think this is one of the things that has, I don't think it's purely contained within this previous decade. I think probably as early as some point in the 2000s, my listening taste really became far more personalized in terms of the things that were important to me, as opposed to the things that I felt like for the culture needed to be put out there and highlighted. But I think, like you, what I gravitated to in coming up with this is, what is the stuff that I actually sat with?
Yeah.
As opposed to those things that I thought like, well, everyone needs to hear this because it's so important. I mean, that's valid, totally valid, but it had to be, what was the stuff that I actually rode for as a listener?
What do you think define the tens in terms of music? Like, we've been in here, we've talked about the 90s, we've talked about the 80s.
Yeah.
What define the tens?
What comes immediately to mind is that, and this is probably true for every previous era, is that it goes beyond just what are the trends in production or genre, because those things in turn, I think, are also going to be impacted by what is the state of the music industry, how are things distributed. And I do think that the really defining feature of the 2010s when it comes to music distribution is the rise of streaming. And when people talk about there being like a Spotify sound, for example, you know, a lot of the music, especially when I look back and let's say my 2019 list of favorite tracks, a lot of that stuff does fall into like that Spotify sound,
yeah,
which is kind of lo-fi, kind of mellow, easygoing. And I do think that when we look back, with having the benefit of more time when we look back, I do think there will be certain kinds of textures and production styles will be noted, partly because of the rise of streaming. And then the other thing that I'm leaving out that's huge is the role of social media
of course.
How certain artists and certain albums get circulated and brought into our awareness. And without getting too far ahead of what we're going to be talking about with some of the artists on our respective lists, I mean, one person who's not on either of our lists but was hugely dominant of the 2010s, Kanye West. Right?
Yeah.
Or Drake, for that matter.
Sure.
And those are both artists who I think you take away the social media component, and I think, especially with someone like Kanye, and I think it changes their impact and how we receive their music. But those become indelible parts of how their music and their artistry help to dominate a particular form of awareness or discourse about music in this decade.
I think I agree with all of those points. Social media and streaming are hallmarks of this decade. But the beginning of social media, for me, was 2009 at least. Twitter pushed itself to the forefront before Instagram. Mm-hmm. And it is there where I started to see this as the DIY decade.
Mm-hmm.
That a lot of people were blowing up on social media and doing it themselves. The
right.
best example in this decade was King and their 3-track EP, The Story, which got handed to a tastemaker, who handed it to Fonte, who handed it to Questlove, who handed it to Erykah Badu, and all this played out on Twitter.
Yeah.
Yo, have you heard this? Yo, have you heard that? And it was the first example, I think this was 2011, that I thought, well, damn, I guess we don't need labels anymore. And the next time I saw them, they were opening for Prince.
Right.
So I thought, there's a lot of power in this thing they're calling Twitter. And as time went on through the decade, I saw more and more artists using that platform and Instagram
mm-hmm.
to make themselves Insta-famous. And what that commodity, what Insta-fame really meant to an
right.
artist,
right.
I've never seen before right. until the tens.
One more thing to throw out there before we actually move on to our decade list here is, in thinking about your question in terms of how are we going to remember the 20-teens, I think in the world of hip hop, certainly the rise and dominance of trap and the sound of trap is going to carry over well into the 2020s.
Sure.
I think the popularity of singing and rapping, so the ways in which hip hop and R&B have become even more overlapped in many cases, that is really what strikes me as again, when we look back on this previous decade, those are things that are going to stand out to us. I'm wondering, in the world of R&B proper, to the extent that we can even call it that, what do you think have been the dominant trends in soul music for the 2010s?
Pop and R&B melded together so that depending on who you asked about a certain artist, you'd always be like, well, are they pop or are they R&B?
Right, right.
And it was sort of like both.
Yeah.
Is Ariana Grande R&B or is she pop?
Yeah.
It depends on who you're talking to, right?
Right.
And it was one of those things that I didn't see those two worlds coming together. I always thought about the 90s that you had a pop group that did a little R&B number for mm-hmm, an album.
Mm-hmm.
Pop R&B became a genre in
right.
this decade.
Yeah.
And it certainly crossed color lines.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Future Soul was still there, but it took a backseat to pop and R&B, certainly towards the end of the decade.
Mm. Well, let's get into our picks here. And just so people know, so the way that we decided to do this is that in this first half, I'll talk about my five of my picks. In the second half, Morgan will do her five. But both of us will post our full top 10 list for the decade on our website at heatrockspod.com. And we absolutely encourage our listeners, if they want to post their own top 10, send it in to us, because we want to know what you thought were the defining albums or whatever favorite. You can define it however you want to, but we want to know what your picks are. I decided to go in chronological order, and we're just going to spin back to 2010. So we're going to go back to the decade's beginning, and my favorite album of that year, Erykah Badu's America Part 2, Return of the Ankh.
This one is bucket life.
Come on, feel me. Just tell me you love me. I like it.
It's kind of weird to realize that this is the only studio album that Erykah put out this entire decade. She had that mixtape.
Sure.
Which was real cool.
Sure.
But, yeah, wait, what's she doing? You know,
chilling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, God bless, because I'm sure she's doing great.
She's earned it. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's wild to think that we're ending, you know, we're at 2020 now and we're ending the decade. And this is the one album that she's put, the one studio album she's put out this entire the last 10 years. And this album, I think, for me at least, my love for it is unabashedly tied to the fact that it's such a 90s throwback LP.
Sure.
The use of the samples, I think, is very deliberate like that,
oh, yeah.
The quotations in there. But as someone who, even though I very much appreciate what Erykah did at the back end of the 90s in terms of helping to lead the neo-soul movement, I think this might actually be my favorite Badu album in terms of just wanting to sit and go end-to-end listen with it. It's Return of the Ankh. And so much on this, even now, 10 years later, every time I hear it, just brings a huge, huge smile to my face.
This is a great album. From the cover art on, I had the opportunity to see her perform songs from this album here. New Year's Eve 2010, we were supposed to give away tickets on the air for her show at the House of Blues. And, of course, my show's 4 to 6, so nobody called in for the pair. So I was like, well, guess we go into to see Erykah Badu.
Mm.
So seeing her on New Year's Eve perform these songs was really magical.
Yeah,
I like this album because, to me, it represents that in some ways she's a creature of habit.
Mm-hmm.
She started the 2000s with Mama's Gun.
Yeah.
So she comes out of the decade swinging. She also used a lot of the Soulquarians on this album. So it's got that sound that you love and that I love.
Yeah.
Poyser, Quest,
mm-hmm.
Georgia Ann Muldrow is on this album. And Georgia Ann Muldrow, she's a producer on my favorite song on the album, which is Out of Mind, Just in Time.
Mm.
And my favorite moment on that song starts at the 2:35 moment where she says,
I gotta do my love for you. Driving screws
for you.
Painting red for you.
It just changes up. And that is straight L.A., straight Georgia Ann Muldrow, from that point on the song to going towards the end. If you love Georgia Ann Muldrow and her music, you'll recognize that signature piano and just that that moody sample based mix. And to me, that was what was so classic about this album, that Erica went back to a group of producers she'd used before, but it just sounded fresh then, and that can still get bumped.
But if I get off my knees, I might recall I'm 20 feet tall.
Next up, we're going to hop to 2013 and an artist and album that I'm 1,000% pretty certain. I guess that wouldn't be 1,000% then, would it? I'm very, very, very certain that, Morgan, you're the one who put me up on this, because I think it was an album that you brought into the aforementioned Tuesday Reviews Day segment on KPCC that we first got linked up through. And this would be Laura Mvula and her debut album, Sing to the Moon.
Oof. I'd love it.
And so on that show, you would have introduced it, and they would have done much the same that we just did now. They would have played a clip. And I just remember thinking, what is this? Who is this? And it's a combination between the lushness, that wall of sound that dominates the kind of symphonic and orchestral arrangements on the album. And then, of course, Mvula's voice. And I was able to catch her at her L.A. show not long after this album dropped that year.
The bootleg?
Yes.
I was there.
Yeah. And I thought it was just magical and just love, love, love this album. And so, and it was a way of me knowing automatically, because this was early into how we got partnered up. I'm like, whoever Morgan Rhodes is, her taste is fucking fire.
Yeah. Thank you, man. I that's always going to be precious to me, because it reminds me of how we met.
Yeah.
And in retrospect, it's like, I didn't even know if they were pairing people up or if we were the first tandem they put together. But either way, that might have just been the Lord putting us together. But the one thing I remember when I first heard this album was, yo, is that her doing everything? Like, is she doing the arrangements? Is she also singing? Is she doing, because it sounds like there's 40 people in the studio with her, but it's all her, right? It's some Matrix, you know, mix.
Yeah.
Once you learn more about Laura Mvula and you find out her background as a choir director, as an arranger, Ranger, how she grew up in her aunt's choir, it all makes sense. And I remember at that show at the bootleg how she apologized for being late. It was her first time in LA, and she got stuck on the 405. I'd been to the bootleg many times. I have never seen an artist command so much silence. I mean, everybody was quiet, and this is LA. Somebody's got to be in there texting or talking or something, but you could hear a pin drop. My jam off of that, and I think that's the one I talked about, is Father, Father. And I tried to place that on a show that I worked on, and they weren't letting me make it.
Let me love.
Side note, too, is I just think when we're reflecting on the 2010s, you have the emergence of these incredible vocalists with such distinctive voices, right? You have Laura, Brittany Howard, Valerie June, and they don't, you wouldn't confuse one for the other, but what I think all three of them share is just this, the way in which they use their instrument and the signature way in which they, the little inflections, the subtleties to it. It was a great decade for female, black female voices.
Absolutely.
All right, moving ahead, we are now in 2015. And I knew automatically there was going to be, there's no way Kendrick Lamar was not going to make this list. And this goes back to something I was talking about. We're around the methodology of how do you come up with, you know, the list of summing up the decade. If this was about the best of the 2010s, then I think Good Kid, Mad City would have been the album pick. But if we're talking about favorite albums, then there's no way that this choice wasn't going to be To Pimp a Butterfly.
right.
And when I wake up, I recognize you looking at me for the pay cut. Bahamas, I be looking at you from the face down. One Mac 11, even boom with the bass down. Skimming, and let me tell you about my life. Painkillers only put me in the twilight. Where pretty pussy and Benjamin is the highlight. I tell my mama I love her.
You talk about artistic vision, ambition, the quality of execution, the range of different, especially LA personnel, ooh, past and present, who collaborated to make this album. In a way, I kind of hope this might, opinion about this might change, because, and it's not to knock down Good Kid, Mad City, because as a concept album in terms of the timelessness of a lot of those songs on there, I mean, Good Kid, Mad City was perfect in many ways. And I know To Pimp a Butterfly, some people find to be a little bit too sprawling, maybe a little overly ambitious, but I would love to be able to think at some future point that actually To Pimp the Butterfly is actually the better album. I don't know if I'm ready to say that. I'm easily ready to say it's my favorite of his stuff this decade. Whether it's better than Good Kid, I don't know. But regardless, I think To Pimp a Butterfly is, if you want to understand the import of Kendrick to the decade, I think this is the album that you can go to, because you can see someone who, as an artist, coming fully into his own and just going for it.
I'ma put the cop to spot me by the White House. Republican run up, get signed out. Hit the press with a Cuban link on my neck. Uneducated, but I got $1 million check like that.
We should never cave. We should never cave. Take his money, go back.
So many scholars unpacked this album, and I didn't read a lot of this stuff until later, after I'd had a chance to sit with it, because quite frankly, I just enjoyed the production.
Yeah.
You know, I just stayed there before I got into the subjects and the themes, because it was just so beautiful. I mean, come on, King Kunta, Complexion, which is one of my jams on there. The fact that, let's read off a few people featured on here. We've got Thundercat, Taz Arnold of Saw Rock Creative Partners, Joseph Lineberg, Terrace Martin, Snoop, Layla Hathaway, Rahsaan Patterson,
oh, wow,
Bilal Anna Wise.
Mm-hmm.
Come on now. And as I mentioned, Complexion, which was not just a great song for him, but a great song for Rhapsody.
Rhapsody, yeah.
And she comes in around the 232 mark.
Where the homegirl Rhapsody at? I need you to speak your mind real quick, loved one.
Let me talk, my Stu Scott. Excuse me on my Tupac. Keep your head up, when did you stop? Love and die. Color of your skin, color of your eyes. That's the real blues, baby, like you met Jay's, baby. You blew me away. You think more beauty.
For all the complaints, I think, of my generation, that the younger generation doesn't hearken back, that they don't respect their elders sonically, that they're on some island and they're doing things new without hearkening back to old music. This debunks all of that. This sounds like a little bit of The Chronic and a little bit of Funkadelic albums,
mm-hmm,
and a little bit of jazz albums. He threw everything on there, all in the name of telling this story. And at the same time, he snuck away and left us with an anthem for all the political unrest. So at the marches across the country, the kids were singing All Right. But it was a moment where I thought, and I've said this before, that he stepped into the role quietly as an elder statesman of hip-hop, with mm-hmm, someone that really had something to say.
I remember you was conflicted, misusing your influence. Sometimes I did the same, abusing my power full of resentment. Resentment that turned into a deep depression. Found myself screaming in the hotel room.
So for my number four, we're going to stay in L.A.
Okay.
And another artist that I knew had to be on my top five was going to be Frank Ocean. The only question was, which Frank Ocean album? And it really comes down between Channel Orange and Blonde. And much as that distinction I just made a moment ago between Good Kid, Mad City and Kendrick's To Pimp a Butterfly, I feel like Channel Orange probably will go down as the more influential album, perhaps the more flawless album, but the album that I actually sat with, and with Blonde in particular, I mean, really, really just heavy, heavy rotation. You got to remember, this comes out late in 2016, and much in the same way that we were talking about in our episode about Tribe Called Quest. We got it from here, coming out just right after the election. I think Blonde was part of that sonic solve, just to nurse in sort of your feelings about at the end of 2016. And I think again, very similar to Pimp a Butterfly, Blonde to me is a more ambitious album. It reaches. You could argue it's more uneven as a quality, as a consequence of its reaching. But when it hits, it's so, so amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the way every day goes. Every time we've no control. If the sky is pink and white, if the ground is black.
One of the things that we joke about here on Heat Rocks is when we ask people, you know, who could do a cover of whatever song off of whatever album we happen to be discussing on any particular show, Frank Ocean is always the right answer. And I think partly because as a singer and as a songwriter, as an interpreter, you really do feel like there's nothing that he can't put a particular spin on that is so signature to who he is. And I haven't really spent enough time trying to figure out what that quality to him is that allows him to do that. But it is 100% there. And I think Blonde just captures, it doesn't have to have like this tight through line. It doesn't have to be a concept album where you have every track is perfectly sequenced with the next. I mean, I love those albums too. To me, Blonde is a bunch of ideas thrown at the wall.
Yeah.
And I'm just trying to throw myself at that wall so I can absorb as much of it as possible.
Sure. It's not this classic gospel run. It's just Frank Ocean.
Yeah.
And I love that about him.
Wishing you Godspeed, glory. There will be mountains you won't move. Still, I'll always be there for you.
I just saw the film Waves a couple of months ago, and it featured so many of Frank Ocean's songs, and it was perfect, and it was sort of that thing. It's sort of like, it was sort of a mix of everything I think about Frank Ocean and Frank Ocean's music.
Mm-hmm.
Even the lead character looked like Frank Ocean on Blonde. He had the bleach blonde hair. He was angst riddled, but also cool and sexy and beautiful and had smart things to say. That's Frank Ocean in a nutshell. Great pick.
We gotta leave. Take down some summertime. Give up just a night.
For my last pick, I was kind of hoping I would find something in 2019 or 2018 just to help bookend the decade. But if I'm being honest here, I really had to go back to 2017 to find an album that I really truly write for as an album to make my list here. And that would be, and again, we're staying in Los Angeles. I think our West Coast bias is really showing in this show today.
Absolutely.
But we're talking about Tyler, the Creator, and his Flower Boy. Number one, it's just such a well-made album. Every cut feels thoughtful. The features that the collaborations, every guest on here, it just feels like it was really, really well thought out. The sound of it is, I could just listen to most of this album on an endless repeat. So on just a basic kind of aesthetic level, I love it. But I think partly also why I wanted to put it here is, I mean, really, who has had a more interesting character arc over the course of the 2010s than Tyler, who started the decade, you know, as part of Odd Future, as someone who was, it seemed like he was courting controversy and trying to be deliberately kind of a dick. And that was kind of his steez, right? And it's not as if Flower Boy was some kind of 180 that no one saw coming from anywhere. I think the album that came out before that, Cherry Bomb, the hints were there. I mean, you could see the progression or there's just the turn. But I wasn't expecting Flower Boy. And I think if you had played it for me and told me this was Tyler, I would not have initially believed you, if not for the fact that his voice is so distinctive. But just to see that kind of, and I want to call it maturation. I don't know if he would call it that. He might say, this was always in me. This has always been who I am. It's not a progression. It's not a maturation. It's just me in a particular moment. But I see it as a maturation because it's him being better in touch, more introspective, you know, there's a lot of honesty on this album about who Tyler is and right. how he identifies. And for all those reasons, I just think Flower Boy is such an amazing work of art.
We were together, you and I, and your wife and your baby. We went to go see the Sister Rosetta play the weekend that this came out. And you asked me, had you heard Flower Boy? And I was like, it is fire.
Yeah.
You played a little bit of it for us in the car. And the first thing I was thinking is like, yo, this is a kinder, gentler Tyler,
right?
This is not the roach eating Tyler
no.
who took the oddness of Odd Future
yeah.
really to a trillion.
Yeah.
Where if you close your eyes and his voice wasn't so distinctive, this could be a Childish Gambino album. All the points that you've made are great ones, and this album was fire.
Right.
Period.
I said, okay, dookie, my infatuation is translating to another form of what you call it. Oh yeah, I ain't met you. I've been looking, stuck and waiting for. I stopped the chasing like an alcoholic. You don't understand.
We will be back with more of our rundown of our 10 favorite albums of the 2010s after a brief word from some of our Max Fun sibling podcasts. Keep it locked.
2020 vision. Cupid hit me with precision. I wonder if you look both ways and you cross my mind.
Hey, I'm Dan McCoy.
I'm Stuart Wellington.
And I'm Elliot Kalin. Together we're The Flophouse,
a podcast where we watch a bad movie and then talk about it.
Movies like Space Hobos, Into the Outer Reaches of the Unknown and the Things That We Don't Know, the movie, and also Who's That Grandma?
Zazzle Zippers, Breakdown 2, and Backhanded Compliment.
Elvis is a Policeman.
Baby Crocodile and the Happy Twins.
Leftover Potatoes?
Station Wagon 3.
Herbie Goes to Hell.
New episodes available every other Saturday.
Available at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bye!
Hello there, ghouls and gals. It is I, April Wolf. I'm here to take you through the twisty, scary, heart-pounding world of genre cinema on the exhilarating program known as Switchblade Sisters. The concept is simple. I invite a female filmmaker on each week, and we discuss their favorite genre film. Listen in closely to hear past guests like The Babadook director, Jennifer Kent, Winter's Bone director, Deborah Granick, and so many others every Thursday on MaximumFun.org. Tune in if you dare.
It's actually a very thought-provoking show that deeply explores the craft and philosophy behind the filmmaking process while also examining film through the lens of the female gaze. So, like, you should listen.
Switchblade Sisters.
Yo, and we're back on Heat Rocks with Oliver and I talking about our favorite 10 albums of the 2010s.
Okay, Morgan, you heard my five. Let's get into your picks. Where do you want to start?
Oh, man. Not surprisingly, I want to start in L.A. And that's with Thundercat and his beautiful, beautiful album, The Golden Age of the Apocalypse. Confession is good for the soul, and I will say that I was not familiar with him until this album. I didn't know of his family's history in the community. I didn't know about the other musicians in his family. This album was my introduction to him. My first impressions was, this guy's nice with his hands. This album is a flex of his skill as a guitar god. I ended up seeing him perform some songs from this album at Royce Hall. You know, he came out with a long Rick James wig on, a bullet belt. He played so long he got a cramp in his hand, and he could sing. I played this album out on KPFK. This is one of the albums that stayed in heavy rotation, so I credit him a lot for being a part of my late night playlist over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure people were tired of me playing this, but to me, this guy was, his talents were prodigious, humble, steeped in 70s funk, but also yacht rock. I've done stuff with Michael McDonald. Yeah. Shout out to Michael McDonald.
Shout out.
This is somebody that I could tell whose pocket was deep sonically, who probably, if I spent some time with him, had great stuff in his crates. And this album was melodic from start to finish. It was the right balance of the right thing. As much as I wanted the guitar and as much as I wanted of his vocals, and it just came swinging out of nowhere. And to your point, it had the LA sound that I came to expect,
right.
And it was moody.
Yeah.
And in the time when this came out, I was also moody. So it was perfect. It was perfect for me. And this was the first time in my memory that there was an artist that I had fallen in love with on the strength of just the guitar playing. I mean, I loved his vocals, but he just made a great front man for his one-man band. He was an eclectic guy. He had played for Suicidal Tendencies for a number of years. He's got a cool cat named Tron. His videos were were wild. It was just like Brain Feeder meets Adult Swim meets L.A., and I love that. I love the part that he was playing in this scene. And I love this album, especially another track called Walkin'.
All right, number two.
This is not L.A., but it might as well have been hell for all the L.A. people that were featured on it. And that's Robert Glasper and Black Radio, the Grammy-nominated Black Radio. Oh, man. Black Radio was appropriately titled because I think what he was trying to say is radio has gone through all types of changes, but when you're listening to adult contemporary Black Radio, and if my generation was at the controls, this is what it would sound like.
Cherish the day.
Came to know him on his jazz albums. But it was a perfect time for this sort of album because the Future Soul indie scene was starting to get a little bit of exposure, and putting them all together on this album and it being Grammy nominated gave them more exposure. He also held a remix contest for the song Move Love, which features King, Amber, Anita Paris, Hometown Heroes. I've already told the story of how they got discovered. So this was a year later, right? A year or two later. But Move Love is one of the prettiest tracks on this album. Classic Robert Glasper piano, classic King vocals. It's just a great sandwich.
Searching for the silver line.
The other thing that was happening around this time with jazz is we were starting to talk about the freshman class of jazz and the new jazz artists, Christian Scott, Terrace Martin, Gretchen Parlato, Robert Glasper, Jason Moran, Chris Bowers, and this was all from that school of people that were sort of like, yeah, we grew up on the standards, we're classically trained, we're going to throw some hip-hop in here. Mos Def is on this album.
Mm-hmm.
You wanna fly, we go far and fast. Built the last, we made this craft. From Black Radio, Black Radio, Black Radio. Black Radio.
So for your number three, you went with, I think, one of the defining pop artists of the 2010s.
An indie artist named Beyonce. Yes, Beyonce. If you don't remember where you were 12, 13, 13, I do. One of my homegirls was like, yo, they saying Beyonce dropped an album. I was like, she ain't dropped an album. And then she had. And I was like, oh my God. We didn't know what we were in for. We didn't know it was going to be songs and videos.
Yeah.
I just was so unprepared. I was like, how can an artist of this magnitude just sneak up on us and do this?
My heart in love, ghost in the sheets. I know if I'm onto you, you must be haunting me. My wicked tongue, where will it be?
This is something that we kind of alluded to but didn't really touch on specifically, which is that when you have the ability to just put your album onto a Spotify or to YouTube or iTunes, whatever, if you're someone like Beyonce and you decide, you know, I'm not going to do the radio single and let that marinate for 2 months and I'm going to have a couple videos, I'm just going to put out a freaking full-length album, videos for every song, and I'm going to do it at midnight with zero promotion, and I'm going to blow this the fuck up. You can do that. I mean, it
exactly.
helps if you're Beyonce, or it yes. helps if you're Kendrick Lamar, but you can do that at that level, which is something that we just had not seen prior. And to me, this was the first album that I remember where, oh shit, they can just jump the line. They can just put stuff out as they want to.
And to your point, I think you have to be at that level to do something like that.
Of course.
Otherwise, if you're an artist nobody cares about, you'd be like, whatever, this fool dropped an album. But the one thing that I thought was just so gangster about it was not only was it a surprise album, but all the videos, and then she just titled it Beyonce. Like, I didn't really even got to get deep, okay? This is called Beyonce, period. I think we were here talking to Tiffany Goucher about Destiny's Child. And I think one of the things that came up is about how even then, we sort of knew that Beyonce was going to get to this point. We sort of knew Beyonce was going to get to be a star.
Right.
Did we know she was going to get here? I don't think so. But she bodied this decade.
Yeah.
Not just this, but Lemonade.
Yeah.
And then Homecoming. And I want to say my family got together and watched this on Christmas. We're doing a new black tradition. We're watching Beyonce together as a family. My niece and nephew had never seen it. And the one thing they kept saying is, she's really amazing. And I think on this album, you get to see a lot about Beyonce. But first and foremost, you get to see that she's really amazing. The visuals were stunning.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't just a bunch of videos. They were like mini, mini movies. They were drawn in.
Mm-hmm.
This was sexy Beyonce. Like real sexy. Not crazy in love.
Drunk in love.
All night, and everything all right. No complaints with my body, so flow resting under these lights. Boy, I'm drinking, walking in my life, 7 minutes. I'm grubbing on it, rubbing. If you scared, call that ribbon. Boy, I'm drinking, keep my brain right. I'm on the brown, yeah, gangsta wife. Do a shit, see, sweat it out like. I'm glad you brought this in. Even though this would not have been my pick, certainly, I would have put Lemonade on my top 10. Above this?
No, it's not so much whether or not it would be above or below. I just, in general, I don't think you can talk about the 2010s without talking about Beyonce. Because
sure.
She went from one of the more, certainly one of the more popular and important artists in the 2010s in terms of having gone solo from Destiny's Child, but just the supernova level
of
power, stardom, influence, the whole nine, respect. That was Beyonce in the 2010s. And between this album and between Homecoming, between Lemonade, which would have been my personal pick because it's the album that I sat with the most, it was just flex after flex flex.
All on Instagram, cake by the pound. Circulate the image every time I come around. G's up, tell me how I'm looking, babe. What is all for you? Just walk my way. Just tell me how it's looking, babe.
All right, number four.
I went with one of my favorites, my favorite artist of all times, which is D'Angelo.
Mm-hmm.
And this was D'Angelo and the Vanguard, Black Messiah.
Another surprise release?
Another surprise release.
Big surprise.
There had been some rumors, but nobody believed that.
Yeah.
It had been too long. And so I think people were like, he's not going to do that. He's not going to make appearances. And so not only did this album come as a surprise, but the subject matter of the album, how political it was,
mm-hmm.
The social justice themes around it came as a surprise. I think with an artist like D'Angelo, we're used to him disappearing for a while. So to the extent that we were happy to hear from him, we were. But I just don't think anyone thought he was going to drop an album here.
Thank you.
I got a chance to see him perform some songs from this album downtown.
Mm.
And he was in perfect form. His band was perfect. His singers were perfect. And he did this thing where on the last song, everyone came off the stage one at a time, till the last man standing was him. So one by one, you know, the singer would leave, and then another singer, and then the drummer, and then somebody on guitar, till it was just him. It was really, really perfect. So for people that were wondering, is he back? He was back in a real way. Mm-hmm. For whatever the conditions of his exile were, self-imposed or otherwise, he sounded great. I love this album, and I think it just came out so strong. I think it's one of the seminal albums of this decade. I think from someone who'd been gone a long time, he clearly had some things to say.
Yeah,
it was of the moment, it was timely, and right on time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, Black Messiah.
So I can't help but notice that your picks here all go in sequential chronological order. Thundercat was 2011, Robert Glasper was 2012, Beyonce was 2013, this D'Angelo album 2014, and your fifth pick stays on pattern with a 2015 choice.
Kamasi Washington, the epic.
The epic.
He couldn't have titled it anything else except maybe the opus, because this is what this is. This is free jazz summer camp. Come as you are, play what you want, play as long as you want, because this album is almost 3 hours long. Okay, there's hella tracks on this album. From a homegrown hero, we're back to L.A. again.
Yep, yep.
A family that's precious to the community. My niece danced at the Lulu Washington Academy there on Crenshaw, and those are his relatives. He is a part of what I was talking about earlier, this freshman class of jazz, where if you close your eyes, this could be Ornette Coleman, or it could be Kamasi. And he bought a 10-piece band with him. And one of my favorite songs on this album is called The Message. I felt like this album did not require you to be a jazz fan. This album just required you to be open-minded, because there were so many influences on this album. Some people thought it was straight ahead free jazz. Some people thought it was a little bit of everything, and it had something for everyone. It was also politicized. He had some things to say.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot was happening. We haven't talked about this part of the decade, that so much was happening socially and culturally and politically, that at least as far as LA was concerned, they were addressing those things full force.
I'm wondering, it's notable, as I was saying before, that all of your albums go in sequential chronological order, but they basically, your picks, at least here, and maybe for the full top 10 list, it'll be a little bit more fleshed out in terms of spanning the decade. But the five that you went with, basically, you stopped mid-decade. So what does that have to say about your thoughts on the back half of the 20-teens?
You know, we talked about how we chose these albums.
Yeah.
And I guess something was happening to me at the beginning of the decade. And I also was doing a lot of thinking. I was also introspective. I'm not going to get into how old I was during this decade, but I will say that I was thinking about some things. And these albums that I've talked about were the soundtracks for some of those thoughts and those moods and some of the things I was writing about, you know, some of the things that I was placing, things that were happening around me. And I don't know what happened in 2016. It's crazy because I almost started with Janelle Monáe, Arch Android, because that was 2010, right? Almost started there. But I liked the album, but I didn't hold on to it in the same way I held on to these.
Right.
And I think something did change around 2016, and I can't put my finger on it. The picks that we put up will reflect 16, 17, 18, and 19, but I will say something happened.
Mm.
I just don't know how to articulate what happened in music or what happened to me, but there's something different. What about you?
It's certainly, to me, more about my personal listening habits rather than something different within the music. You know, if I had I don't know if it would have made my top 10, but you just mentioned Janelle Monáe, but Dirty Computer.
Sure.
I think if I had a top 15 list, that album would easily make there just in terms of like just the quality of a concept album, the level of execution. But if I'm being honest, I didn't sit with that album nonstop. There are a few tracks on there that I really ride for, but it's not an album that once I got into it, I'm like, oh, this is all I want to listen to. And again, I don't know if that says more about the music. I always assume it just says something more about me. And it could be that, you know, in the week after we tape this, there's going to be something in 2020 that is going to be that album where I'm just going to listen to that thing to death.
Sure.
Who knows? It just didn't happen nothing sparked that same level of engagement in the last 2 years.
That said, though, but our lists are so similar. We're sort of circling very similar wagons. There isn't that far of a stretch between Thundercat and Erica. And Thundercat has played with Erica.
Right.
And Thundercat has played with Kendrick. And, you know what I'm saying? Robert Glasper played on To Pimp a Butterfly, who's also played with King. So we're circling sort of who's also played with Kamasi.
Yeah.
So we're sort of circling the same.
Oh, totally.
You know?
Which is a lot, I think, just about you and I and our tastes. And they happen to run very much parallel and overlap. That said, we each picked a honorable mention album. And for me, I decided to go with something that was very left field compared to everything else I have listed here. And it's an album that I had kind of forgotten that I had given heavy, heavy rotation run to until I went back, I think, into my iTunes and I sorted by most played. And I remembered, back in 2012, I was listening heavy, heavy to Rufus Wainwright's Out of the Game. And this is not an album or an artist that I think most people who know my taste would necessarily associate me with because he's not an R&B or not a hip-hop artist. To me, he is the king of Baroque pop. But I've been listening and really enjoying Rufus's work since the early 2000s, which is when I first discovered him. His debut self-titled album, his album Poses, which was really my intro to him. And I thought Out of the Game was just everything I love about Rufus in terms of his approach to songwriting, his approach to his music making. That Baroqueness that I mentioned just a moment ago is all there to listen to. And I think a lot of people who know my taste, they wouldn't assume that Rufus would be that high up there. But when I think about the albums that really gave me joy and pleasure in the 2010s, Out of the Game is definitely there. What's your honorable mention, Morgan?
My honorable mention goes back to L.A. No surprise there.
Not even back.
We're not leaving L.A. It's an artist named Sonny Colon. He's from L.A. and an album called Psychedelic, which came out actually in 2018. I fell in love with him the year before and we placed him on Dear White People. But a lot of people think he sounds like Frank Ocean and they say that he's very ethereal. Art rock meets Frank Ocean. I fell in love last year with a song called Morning Dew. I almost picked Frank Ocean Channel Orange, but I went with Sonny Colon, brothers from a different mother.
Well, Morgan, it has been a pleasure getting to know you across this past decade. I hope that only continues with this upcoming one that we are now have stepped our foot into.
Yeah.
And it's been glorious. It's been blessed.
It has been. And there have been so many wonderful music moments that we have shared together, not just on this podcast, but outside of this podcast, conversations that we've had, you know, artists that we've loved that we realized that we had in common. I mean, we've got a shared love for Bette Davis. The moments that we've had here in Heat Rocks, and again I just thank KPCC for bringing you into my life, man. And
shout out Jacob Margolis as always,
for sure. And for Tuesday Reviews Day, and shout out to Laura Mvula, who's the sort of the person that brought us together.
You've been listening to Heat Rocks with me, Oliver Wong, and Morgan Rhodes.
Our theme music is Crown Ones by Thess One of People Under the Stairs. Shout out to Thess for the hookup.
Heat Rocks is produced by myself and Morgan, alongside Christian Duenas, who also edits, engineers, and does the booking for our shows.
Our senior producer is Laura Swisher, and our executive producer is Jesse Thorne.
We are part of the Maximum Fun family, taping every week live in their studios in the Westlake neighborhood of Los Angeles. Rated the 51st best neighborhood in LA, according to StreetAdvisor.com, but number one in our hearts. We want to thank all of our five-star iTunes reviewers, including Justin Soletta, who wrote to say that we are a, quote, well-balanced, informative podcast hosted by people who know what they're talking about, unquote. I really hope that's true. If you, listener, have not had a chance to leave us a review yet, please, please consider doing so, because it is such a vital way that new listeners can find their way to us.
We also want to thank our social media fans and family, including the following. I want to shout out Jason Woodbury, who was reflecting back on his year and the wonderful conversation he had with us about Karen Dalton. We also want to thank Noam Nomsky for just giving us love in general. We want to thank Tim Nakuza who said, thank you for this podcast. Thank you, man, for the shout. As usual, we want to thank Gregory the Height, who's been holding us down from the beginning. Kevin Zapp, who's been holding us down. We also want to thank Robert Jamie. We've got a lot of people to thank. Bill Kitchen. We also want to thank Grimm. We want to thank Bill McKibben, Fuzz T1, Bass Reeves. As always, Dadbot Rap Pod for shouting us out, holding us down.
Yes, yes.
Gang weaponized ASMR. Thank you, gang. We also want to thank Cryptic One. And finally, we want to thank John Gotti and Iron Mike Tundra. We do so appreciate the tweezies and the retweezies. Good to see you, Oliver.
Good to see you too, Morgan. One last thing. Here's a teaser for next week's episode. And we are starting 2020 off right, because we have none other than Wendy and Lisa joining us to talk about Prince's Around the World in a Day. It is a super special episode, and we cannot wait for y'all to hear it.
That summer, we were all like rehearsing for the next tour and recording a whole bunch of albums at the warehouse. There was a whole bunch of other bands that were around, and recording was happening simultaneously as being in other rooms rehearsing. And Jonathan and David drove up to rehearsal and gave us a cassette of David's song, Around the World in a Day. And the two of us listened to it in Lisa's car. And we both looked at each other and said, we have to play it for Prince. Mm. He's going to lose his mind. Mm. Prince was like, can I have it?
Get David on the phone.
Can I have that? Can I have that? And that's how Around the World in a Day started. That song was the epicenter of the creative process for Prince to create everything else around it.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.